Okay, this is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is 27 May 2010. The time is approximately 1:10 p.m. Eastern Standard. I'm accompanied by Brad Bondi of the FCIC and telephonically by Mr. John Rutherford and attorneys from Sullivan and Cromwell. We are at the offices of the FCIC for the interview of Mr. Rutherford. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Rutherford. And Mr. Rutherford, could I get your verbal assent to that?
Yes, sir, you have my assent.
Thank you. When I conclude this preamble, I'll tell you what, will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name. I'll start. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I. Mr. Bondi?
Brad Bondi, B-O-N-D-I, Deputy General Counsel of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
This is Sharon Nellis, N-E-L-L-E-S, from Sullivan and Cromwell. With me is Matt Sullivan from Sullivan and Cromwell.
And John Rutherford, R-U-T-H-E-R-F-U-R-D. I'm retired from Moody's and at the moment just a private citizen.
Okay. Mr. Rutherford, Mr. Bondi was good enough to give you a bit of background. The FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It's bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I could provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC...
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And please just let us know through Ms. Nellis if you're interested. And we can shuttle that along. Be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code Section 1001 concerning false statements. With that, Mr. Rutherford, just a couple of ground rules. If you could, please let us complete questions before you start to answer so that we don't have crosstalk. And please make all your responses verbal and audible so we get a quality transcript. And with that, Mr. Bondi.
This is Sharon Nellis. If I may, just before we start, I just want to note that as Mr. Cunicelli also noted, that this is not a deposition, this is or sworn testimony, but this is, as I understand it, an interview, and as Mr. Rutherford understands it, an interview, and of course, as such, and this is not governed by the federal rules of civil procedure or any other rules of civil procedure, and it is not the role of me today to clarify the record or make objections. But rather to allow the conversation to take place. But the fact that the record is not being protected by counsel, I only note solely in the event that this transcript, which I understand is being made to assist you in your work, becomes public for any other reason.
Unless the chairman and vice chairman acting together or a majority of the commissioners decide to make the transcript public, it will remain non-public.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Rutherford, if you would, I know your background and have read up on you, but if you would, for our background and purposes, briefly describe your background for us and your employment background. I understand for purposes that you are have a law degree from Harvard and a Bachelor's of Art from Princeton. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
And following that, I understand you had founded a company. If you could take us through your employment history, we would appreciate that briefly.
Yes, sir. I worked for Sherman & Sterling from 1966 to 1968 as an associate. At that point, I left Sherman & Sterling to work for a company called White Weld, which was then an investment bank, which set up a company called Interactive Data Corporation, IDC. I worked for IDC essentially from the 1968 period until 1980 in various capacities. During that time, IDC was purchased from Whitewell and the other investors by Chase Manhattan Bank. In 1980, I left IDC to work for Chase Manhattan Bank in what they call their information services department, which essentially held their interests in IDC and a number of other permissible activities for national banks. In 1985, I went back to IDC as president. IDC was at some point sold, I don't remember the year, by Chase to Dun & Bradstreet Corporation. I continued as president of IDC until 1995, when IDC was sold to Pearson PLC. At that point, I went to work for Dun & Bradstreet in the Moody's company.
That was 1995, sir?
That was 1995. I started at Moody's on October 1st of 1995, because IDC was sold September 30th. And I worked in various positions at Moody's until towards the end of April of 2005, when I retired at 65, which I had attained in February of that year, and I've been retired since then.
Sir, if you would, take us through the positions that you have held at Moody's, starting from when you joined in October of 1995. Did you join in the ratings business, and what roles did you have?
Yes, sir. Well, the first month at Moody's, I spent as a consultant to Pearson, who had bought Interactive Data from Dun & Bradstreet. So I really started, although my official employment started early, I really started a month later. And I believe my position was managing director for business development. And the idea of that position was to try to understand what additional businesses would make sense for Moody's to get involved in. And then a year or so later, I became the chief administrative officer of Moody's. As business development, I had reported to John Baum, who was then the president of Moody's. Mr. Bond was replaced by Bill Dwyer, William O. Dwyer. And when I became chief administrative officer, I reported to Mr. Dwyer. Mr. Dwyer had been president of Moody's previously, and had returned as president. And then I believe it was probably 98 or so when I became a president of Moody's. Moody's became a public company in September of 2000. And at that point, I became president and chief executive officer of Moody's. When Cliff Alexander retired as chairman of Moody's, and I'm not sure what that year was. I became chairman and CEO until I retired in April of 2005.
Thank you. Tell us about the growth of the business and the challenges that you faced when Moody's spun off from Dun & Bradstreet and became its own company.
We thought, and I still think, that at that time there were three very important currents of growth that provided tremendous opportunities for Moody's. The first was disintermediation. The second was internationalization of finance. And the third was the growth of structured finance. Mm-hmm. So those were the three major propellers of Moody's growth at that time.
And sir, on disintermediation, are you referring to the involvement of shareholders directly as opposed to intermediaries like investment advisors and the like? What do you mean by that?
I'm sorry, I didn't wish to interrupt you, sir.
Oh, no, thank you. I appreciate that. I was trying to understand what you meant by disintermediation. Could you explain that to us, please?
Yes. It was the growth of the public capital markets, the public debt markets, whereby companies decided to borrow in the public debt markets rather than purely from their banks. If they borrowed purely from their banks and those loans weren't syndicated, those loans did not usually become rated. Whereas if they if companies borrowed in the public debt markets, they normally obtained ratings. That was a trend that was important in the United States, but it was also very important in Europe and propelled Moody's growth in Europe at that time.
Okay. And of the three, disintermediation, the internationalization of finance, and the growth of structured products, which of those did you view as the fastest growing area at the time that Moody's became a separate company?
Right. The reason I'm hesitating, sir, is that they a little bit overlap. That is, disintermediation was overlapped with internationalization. And there was growth of structured finance both domestically and internationally. But if you had to pick out one of the three, it would clearly be structured finance.
And how did you strike that? What were your goals for objectives for Moody's participation in the rating of structured finance products when Moody's became a separate company in 2000?
We wanted to participate in the growth of those markets.
And how did Moody's go about, though, ensuring that it would be a participant in the rating of structured finance products?
In order to do that, we had to obtain the necessary expertise, and we had to We had to show the other market participants that we had something relevant to say about the products that they wanted to offer on the one hand and the products that they were considering purchasing on the other hand.
Who did you task to head the structured finance business?
I don't remember, you know, in let's say 1998. I'm a little weak on the organization chart there. I believe at that time the head of structured finance was a gentleman named Don Noe, N-O-E.
And was Mr. Noe in that position in 2000 when Moody's became a separate company and you became president and CEO?
I do not believe so. I may be wrong, but I think by 2000, Mr. Noe had left the company, and I'm not sure who was in charge of structured finance at that time.
Okay. In September of 2000, when Moody's becomes its own standalone company, what sort of goals did you set for Moody's rating business with respect to structured finance? Did you have any goals for your managers?
I'm sure I did, but I can't tell you what they were.
Do you remember generally what type of goals you would have set forth in 2000 for the structured finance rating business?
Well, we had a financial plan. We had a financial plan for the year 2000. We had a financial plan for each year. That financial plan was broken down by both product area and geography. So that would have covered revenue goals, and it would have covered the resources that the company was willing to make available for the various areas of the company by product and by geography.
How important to you was it that Moody's participate in rating of all the deals that were rated in the market?
Perhaps I'm wrong, but the word you use the word all, and you know, I don't think it was ever Moody's objective to rate all the deals in the market. I remember that Moody's occasionally refused to rate deals for various reasons.
There's a term that I've heard called market coverage. What is? Do you have a? Have you heard that term, market coverage?
Yes, sir.
And is that a term that you would have used while president and CEO of Moody's?
I don't recall. I can tell you what it means to me.
Okay. What does market coverage mean?
It has to do with the fact that investors value broad coverage, so that they value that a rating agency has coverage on most of the instruments of a particular asset class, so they can think about the various ratings relative to that asset class. And if a rating agency only has ratings on a few of the instruments in that asset class or geography, investors generally view the ratings to be less valuable.
I see. So is having market coverage a goal that you would have aspired for your employees to have in the growth or in the structured finance rating side of the business? Did you want your people to effectively have market coverage?
Yes, but there were some. For example, I remember one or more instances where we declined to cover or to rate a security because we didn't trust the manager, we didn't believe we were getting sufficient information from the manager.
Is it fair to say, though, that if you were getting sufficient information, if there was sufficient information to rate the deal, you wanted Moody's to rate it?
Yes, I believe that that is a value that Moody's has.
And one person with whom we spoke, Mr. Rutherford, said described it as we needed to rate all the deals that we could potentially rate. So if a deal was able to be rated, we should be rating it. Is that generally the view that was held while you were CEO of Moody's?
We should rate it at the appropriate rating level. Yes, sir.
Moody's... Moody's in 2002 achieved a milestone, I understand, in terms of revenue. Do you recall what that milestone was?
Perhaps that was $1 billion of annual revenue.
Yes, sir. And what do you attribute to the growth of Moody's revenue from 2000 to 2002? What were the drivers of that revenue?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm going to say what I said before. My recollection was that it was disintermediation, internationalization, and structured finance.
I see. And of the three, would you still say if you had to choose one of the three, it was structured finance? I understand there's overlap,
yes, sir.
Of course. Okay. We've heard about the so-called inherent conflicts of interest with the issuer's pay model of ratings. My question is, with respect to the structured finance group, if you can limit your answer to that, if your answer applies across the board, then feel free to give an answer across the board. But with respect to the structured finance group, what sort of inherent conflicts of interest existed at Moody's during your tenure as CEO?
Well, the issuers of structured, or the arrangers of structured finance securities, generally wanted higher ratings, which meant less over-collateralization. The purchasers would prefer more over-collateralization. People who already owned the security didn't want a downgrade. Shorts would want a downgrade. Generally, the management problem was to try to manage all of these various interests who wanted different things.
And how did you as the CEO manage these inherent conflicts that you've described?
Well, the I think a very important achievement of that period was the creation, which I believe Moody's was the leader in, of the IOSCO Code of Conduct, which specified sort of the duties of both the rating agency and the people within the rating agency. Other elements were to strengthen the process and procedures for rating committees, to write that down and to make sure that everybody understood it. And then also importantly, we had an initiative to try to determine our forecasting ability in corporate finance, and we attempted to extend that to the area of structured finance.
Who is Brian Clarkson?
Mr. Clarkson was an important manager of Moody's certainly towards the end of my period there. He was responsible for structured finance.
Did he report to you?
No, sir. I believe he reported to Mr. Raymond McDaniel, who was my successor, and who, when I was there, certainly at the end, was the chief operating officer of Moody's.
Did you have much interaction with Mr. Clarkson while you were employed at Moody's, while you were the CEO? Did you have much interaction with him? And if so, what type of interaction would you have had with Mr. Clarkson?
Well, I attended a number of his presentations that he would make to general management meetings. He would attend the larger group of senior managers that I had meetings with. That was the primary interaction.
Were you involved directly or indirectly in setting any goals for Mr. Clarkson?
I'm sure I approved the goals for Mr. Clarkson that Mr. McDaniel set. There was an annual goal-setting process at Moody's for both financial and non-financial objectives, and to that extent, I was involved largely in approving Mr. Clarkson's goals.
And could you explain how that process worked of setting goals?
Annually, we were asked by the board to set non-financial goals for managers, and the board approved those goals with regard to the more senior managers.
And who would have been what levels would have been senior enough to have been approved by the board?
My recollection, I may be wrong on this. My guess would be that it was senior managing directors and above.
And these goals that were approved by the board, would they have been only the non-revenue, non-business goals, or did the board also approve the business goals as well, the revenue-related goals and market coverage-related goals?
My recollection is that the financial goals were approved as part of a financial plan. So the chief financial officer presented the financial plan, and the board approved that plan. I do not believe that market coverage goals were at all included in that financial plan. There was a separate set of non-financial objectives, which I submitted to the board, and which the board considered and approved. And I do not remember whether market coverage goals were included in those non-financial objectives or not.
Did you consult with a compensation consultant or consulting firm?
Moody's employed a such a firm, yes, sir.
When was that, and what was the firm?
I believe that we did that after Moody's became a separate public company, and I believe the firm was Johnson, but I'm a little weak on that.
Okay. Do you remember the name or names of any of the consultants at Johnson with whom you may have interacted?
The person with whom we interacted was the principal of the firm, and the firm bore his name.
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry, I just don't remember it at the moment.
I see, but you said Johnson was the name of the firm, so it would have been Mr. Johnson.
That's what I recall, but I'm telling you that my recollection is weak.
Did the consulting firm, which you believe is the Johnson firm, did that firm do any report for the board or for senior management?
Yes, sir. The nature of their work was to develop a comparison universe. Secondly, to tell the board where a number of positions that were held at Moody's rated compared to similar positions in that comparison universe. And third, to make general recommendations to the board about compensation.
And what do you recall that comparison universe to be? Was it other ratings firms, S&P, Fitch, or was it non-rating companies? What would have been the universe of comparison?
I believe that the problem that the consultants had was that they could only really get proxy information, so they had to be public companies. They were the likes of some of the insurers, the bond insurers. I'm sure that the corporate records of Moody's contain you know, the materials that were presented to the board by this consulting firm.
And would that have been in around late 2000, or was that into 2001 or later?
As I recall, we employed the firm throughout my tenure. That is, it would have commenced in 2000 and continued until 2005, and I don't remember whether the firm, I don't know whether the firm continued to employ, whether Moody's continued to employ the firm thereafter.
Were the recommendations of this consulting firm with respect to compensation and compensation structure accepted by Moody's? Were they implemented by Moody's?
My recollection is that the firm recommended higher base compensation than I was recommending. My recollection is that they felt that the compensation was fair, but only because Moody's was at the time substantially outperforming its financial goals. And therefore, the compensation turned out to be fair and reasonable, but they did not agree with me on the structure of that compensation. Again, I think the records of the company probably will provide more information than I can remember on this.
Great, thank you. And did you employ any other consulting firms for any strategic or business decisions?
The only thing I can remember is that we employed BCG, Boston Consulting Group, for two projects related to quantitative ratings. That had to do with the activities which are now a part of Moody's Analytics. And you may have heard the name KMV.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of activity. That's the only one that I can remember now.
Okay. So it wouldn't have been on the rating of any of the instruments like structured finance products or those sorts of ratings?
No, sir.
And nothing generally related to any strategic decisions, business-wise decisions, that other than what you've described so far?
I can't remember any, sir.
Okay. What if you recall, were some of the discussions that you had over the years with respect to compensation, in particular compensation of persons involved in the ratings part of the business, like analysts and managing directors?
Well, we at the time of the becoming a public company, we set up a general compensation framework of annual salary, annual bonus, and stock incentive, long-term incentive by stock options.
And why was it important to have incentive-based compensation for analysts and managing directors?
I thought it was, it seemed like, well, I guess I thought we needed to compete in the market for talent, and we always had to consider, you know, what was the employee value proposition, and I thought that in competing with other organizations to which valued employees could go, that type of compensation was appropriate.
What sort of safeguards did you consider or employ to ensure that employees were not incented to place business concerns over the quality of the rating itself?
Well, I think the IOSCO code of conduct, which Moody's adopted, was very important, and we made efforts to make sure that was known by our employees. That code clearly states that people should call it the way they saw it, on the basis only of credit, and not on the basis of advantage to or disadvantage to issuers or investors or Moody's or themselves. Another very important control was the fact that rating opinions were determined by committee and not by a single analyst. And finally, we had our effort to understand, you know, how our forecasting was going in both the corporate and the structured finance area. So, you know, those were the principal controls under the knowledge that, you know, if we were going to be a successful business, our ratings had to be good ratings.
And Mr. Rutherford, did any events happen during your tenure where you believed that any employee or employees placed revenue or market coverage or any other factor above the actual quality of the rating?
No, sir.
No events whatsoever that you can recall?
Not while I was there, no, sir.
Okay. I take it you would not know if that occurred after you left, or do you know of any that occurred after you left?
I have no personal direct knowledge of it. I am, you know, I have become aware of the issues with regard to what are they called? These trading strategies.
Are you referring to the constant proportion debt obligation, CPDOs?
Yes, sir. Thank you for reminding me of what that meant.
And you, do you have any firsthand knowledge of any of the events associated with CPDOs?
No, sir.
Okay. it has been reported, sir, and we've heard a bit about pressure from issuers and investment banks. Is that something that you witnessed during your tenure as CEO? Any pressure from issuers or banks on the rating process, that is?
Well, I mean, in connection with Enron, there was, interest in influencing the rating. I believe there was a Senate report on that matter, and it was quite a long time ago, so I believe that probably that's a better source than my recollection.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to the Enron matter, Moody's received a fair amount of criticism in around February of 2001 for failing to downgrade Enron's credit ratings credit rating earlier than it did. Were there any lessons learned in your mind from the Enron incident and experience? Any sort of broad lessons that you took away from that time?
The broad lesson was the lesson that became embodied in the IOSCO Code of Conduct, which was that in doing a rating, you should consider only credit considerations and not the effect on the company, the effect on investors in the company, or the effect on Moody's.
How successful do you believe that the IOSCO code was at preventing employees from looking at those other external factors that should not be considered in the rating process?
I think the only violation of that I've heard of related to the CPDO affair, where I believe the company took very forthright action.
In a letter, sir, that I've read that you had written to the New York Times on around February 27, 2002, concerning the Enron incident, I understand your argument, and please tell me if my understanding is correct. In the letter, it seemed to me that you were arguing that Moody's is privy only to publicly available information, and that Enron was not withholding any relevant information to Moody's. Is that a fair takeaway of your letter?
Sorry, I simply do not recall the letter, and I don't have it in front of me.
That's fair enough, sir. When Moody's did reach the $1 billion mark in 2002, was that fairly widely celebrated within the company?
I do not recall. I don't think it was a major celebration.
Do you recall sending forgive me the lack of terminology, I know these only from deal days where they were called tombstones, and with the actual deal set up on the placard. But do you recall that Moody's gave out to all of its employees a paperweight that said something like Moody's Corporation achieves $1 billion in revenue in 2002. Do you recall anything like that taking place?
I do not, sir.
Okay.
I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I'm just saying I don't remember it.
Mm-hmm. And with the growth of the business, were you compensated for the growth of the business, the growth of revenue?
I think indirectly, in the sense that I was compensated for meeting and exceeding the company's annual financial plans, which had a revenue component, and I was compensated by options, which had to do with how the market valued the company, and it's reasonable to think that the market was looking at revenue growth in making that valuation.
And according to data that we have uncovered, in 2005, it was reported that you received a bonus of $552,871, a salary of $273,000, and restricted stock awards of approximately $404,200. So, approximately $552,000 in bonus, $273,000 in salary, and $404,000 in stock awards, along with options to purchase around 65,000 shares. Is that a fair estimate, if you recall?
I'm not sure, but I would like to just point out one thing to you,
mm-hmm.
that 2005 was a stub year for me. So I only worked essentially 4 months out of that year.
I see. So that was for the first few months.
Well, I'm not sure. That's just something you should check.
I will. I appreciate that.
In other words, I think a figuring, if you want to ask me about compensation,
mm-hmm.
2004 was a full year.
Yes, sir. Look, what I'm getting at is just generally speaking, can you tell me about your compensation and what were the factors that went into the various components of your compensation as CEO?
Well, I think there were financial objectives which were viewed as compared to the annual financial plan. There were non-financial objectives which I had proposed and which the board had set for me. And there was the option-based compensation. And the annual salary was largely based on the comparisons that that firm which I'm referring to as Johnson had done.
Mm-hmm. There was a report by Risk Metrics that suggested that in 2003, your compensation was your direct compensation was a total of $6.2 million, which, according to Risk Metrics, was about 158% above the peer group's compensation of about $2.4 million. Do you recall being criticized or receiving any criticism for your compensation being higher than any peer groups?
I do not recall, no.
Okay. I'd like to ask you about the ratings process generally, but my question is this, is were there any efforts or implementation of any efforts to audit the ratings process? In other words, to check to see if the ratings committees were coming up with the best rating they could?
Well, we had the effort to in credit policy to better understand our forecasting ability, and that was undertaken for both the corporate and financial institution franchise, and also the structured finance franchise. That was largely a statistical effort, and I'm not sure that I don't think I would characterize it as an audit, but it had the objective of trying to understand whether we were doing a good job or a less than good job in our ratings.
Did you ever consider having an actual audit process whereby the ratings themselves and the process that the committee undertook to reach those ratings was done in the best fashion possible?
I can remember no such no such effort or consideration of undertaking an audit process.
I ask you about a few statements that have been attributed to you, and I'll read the statements, and if you can just explain to me what you recall meaning by them. The first statement was from a New York Times article written by Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, December 6, 2008. And there's a quote in there attributed to you, and I'll just read it. The quote is, quote, "Moody's has to be all the time both a standards business and a service business. I wasn't in Moody's in the old days, so to speak, but I think I always understood both elements of what we had to do." First of all, do you recall making a statement along those lines?
Yes, sir. I believe many times I made the statement that Moody's has to be both a standards and a service business.
Can you explain what you mean by that statement?
Standards means setting standards for ratings, what ratings should mean, and adhering to those standards. And it has to do with two elements. The first is the absence of corruption in the rating process, and the second is getting the rating right as seen after the fact by a statistical process. Service means having good customer service, responding to telephone calls, meeting deadlines, and the rest. It does not mean lowering the rating standards for the purpose of pleasing the customer.
And with respect to the service business, the service element of that, Were you involved in any initiatives to improve the service side of that, answering telephone calls, being responsive to inquiries for ratings? Were you involved in any efforts to improve on the service side of the business?
I wasn't primarily involved, but I certainly supported those efforts.
Okay. Can you tell me about some of those efforts that took place while you were with Moody's as CEO?
Well, I remember that there was an effort to meet with leaders of investment banks and to understand whether they had concerns about Moody's and the service elements. There were efforts to survey people and ask them about, what rating agency would best meet their future needs and the sorts of things which survey firms do.
And when were these taking place?
I think they were taking place more or less continuously. From when I became president, say 98, throughout my tenure.
And what sort of changes did you implement upon receiving feedback from these outreach and survey efforts?
I mean, there were all sorts of things ranging from as simple as better scheduling of conference rooms, having better lighting in the conference rooms, providing training, various types of training to our analyst employees. Those are the sorts of things I can remember.
Were there personnel changes as well, termination of employees?
There were changes in personnel where it was believed that the individual was not providing appropriate customer service.
Tell me about those changes in personnel. In what groups, who made them, and how many people were involved?
On the customer service side, I can remember only one, which isn't to say that there weren't more. It's just this is the only one where I can give you a name. It was in the residential area. And the individual was named Mark Adelson.
And tell me what happened with Mark Adelson.
He joined an investment bank. I believe it was Nomura in the residential mortgage area, and he may have other things, but I believe he's now chief credit officer at S&P.
Mm-hmm. I should have been clearer. What happened to prompt an action taken against Mr. Adelson, and what was taken with respect to Mr. Adelson? Was he fired?
I believe he was fired, yes, sir.
Why was he fired?
Because he was not providing the level of service to customers which Moody's wished to provide.
And could you elaborate what he was doing that wasn't the level of service that Moody's viewed as being appropriate?
Well, I think it was simple things like returning phone calls, meeting deadlines, communicating with people what Moody's standards were and how proposals might or might not be meeting standards.
And how did you learn this information? Was it from the issuers and investment banks with whom Mr. Adelson dealt?
I was not, no, I only learned this after the fact. I was not personally involved in the decision with regard to Mr. Adelson.
But my question, though, is how did Moody's, the company, learn about Mr. Adelson's customer service level? Was that from the outreach efforts to talk to the issuers and the investment banks?
I don't know the details. I would refer you to probably to Brian Clarkson for the information that it seems that you are seeking.
And was Mr. Clarkson, to your understanding, involved in the decision to terminate
Yes,
Mr. Adelson?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Were there other personnel changes in the area of residential mortgage-backed securities as a result of any outreach efforts to the investment banking community or issuer community?
Let me respond by simply saying I'm not saying that the action taken with respect to Mr. Adelson was a caused by this outreach. You know, the people who took that action, I don't know why they came to this conclusion. It may have been through their own observation. It may have been through outreach. It may have been through complaints. That's not something I know. All I know was that I recall that Mr. Adelson was asked to leave because he was considered deficient in this area.
Were others at or around the same time that Mr. Adelson was fired, were there any other personnel changes in the area of residential mortgage-backed securities?
I don't recall any. That isn't to say that there weren't any. It's just I don't remember what they were.
Did Moody's business improve as a result of Mr. Adelson being fired?
Well, Moody's residential mortgage rating business obtained more revenues after Mr. Adelson left, but whether that was caused by Mr. Adelson's departure or by just a general increase in market activity in that area, I would guess it was more the latter than the former.
There's another quote that was attributed to you about in the connection to downgrades and the downgrade associated with Enron. And I'll read the quote. This was from, this quote happened to be from Fortune Magazine, December 24th, 2001. He said, "We do not want to rush to judgment, nor do we delay in informing investors when we believe fundamentals have changed." What sort of efforts did you put into place as CEO to ensure that downgrades were being implemented in an appropriate and timely fashion? In other words, to paraphrase your quote, so that you weren't rushing to judgment nor delaying in informing investors. What sort of efforts did you make to ensure that downgrades were implemented in the timely and appropriate fashion?
I'm not sure that I was personally involved in that activity, but the institutional activity had to do with, again, the IOSCO Code of Conduct, which talks about monitoring responsibilities. There was a process of which was called portfolio reviews, whereby on a periodic basis, at least annually, rating groups would get together and review all of the types of companies in a particular industry to make sure that they were correctly positioned against each other. There are probably more, but those are what I can remember.
Mm-hmm. The structured finance business grew and evolved in the early part of the decade while you were CEO. What sort of efforts did you make as CEO to ensure that Moody's had the appropriate tools and resources to keep up with the evolving and growing structured finance business?
Well, the main effort which we weren't always successful in was to increase our analytical staff.
And why were you not always successful in increasing analytical staff?
Unfortunately, investment banks often took our more senior people and paid them more money, so we were always faced with this revolving door.
And by the term revolving door, did you mean to suggest that they come back eventually to Moody's, or you mean to suggest that they leave to go to the investment banking world and stay there?
As I recall, most of the time, if they left to go to the investment banking world, they stayed there. They did not come back to Moody's.
Mm-hmm. And was that a problem with investment banks recruiting Moody's employees? Was that a concern to you?
It was a concern to the extent that we were losing human talent and had to regrow that talent.
Were you concerned at all with the impact on the rating process itself?
No, sir. The reason is that Moody's would extend, especially in structured finance, Moody's would publish its models in computer form so that they could be exercised by both arrangers and investors. So I don't think that they had a knowledge advantage particularly. It just made it difficult to replace the talent within the company.
Did you put into place any prohibitions against former Moody's employees who went to issuers and investment banks from then engaging Moody's on the rating process?
Were there I do not believe that we did that.
Was that something you considered doing?
There may have been European suggestions to that effect, but I do not believe that we ever really considered them.
What do you mean by European suggestions? I'm sorry.
The idea of those timeout periods, I think, was more common in Europe.
And what was the rationale for not implementing a timeout period in the United States?
Because we did not believe that people who had left Moody's had any significant advantage over other people on either the arranger or the or the investor side, because we published the models and the computer codes of those models for everybody to see and understand.
Mr. Rutherford, Vic Cunicelli, I have a question for you on that. I interviewed a couple of Moody's employees yesterday who were responsible for putting together some of those models, Mr. Jay Siegel and Roger Stein. And sometimes, like Mr. Siegel, for instance, said that he believed more in the result of the output from committee than he believed in the output from the model. In other words, that model being out there and being public, that wasn't an output that Moody's just took. It was much more, he was much more interested in what happened in committee and what analysts said and whatnot, and that they could overrule that that model output. So, I mean, would that surprise you, number one, that one of your modelers feels that what happens in committee is a lot more important than a model output?
Well, I have a great deal of respect for Jay Siegel. I think he was an outstanding employee, and he certainly knows more about ratings than I do. So I think you should listen to him.
Okay, I guess just taking off from there, does it erode the value of the model being out public and in the marketplace if what happens in committee can override it?
Well, certainly from a philosophical standard, Moody's has always said that the committees are the final arbiters of determining a rating. So I'm not at all surprised that committees are the most important things.
Okay. And do you publish committee memos?
Moody's does not. Certainly when I was there, Moody's does not publish committee memos.
Okay, so the model's public, but the committee and the way the committee can maybe change inputs to the model or whatnot is not a public thing?
I'm not sure I understood your question, sir. Is it that a individual committee can change the model? Is that the question?
Actually, it's a bit more than an individual committee. I believe what Mr. Siegel and Stein said was that at times market conditions change, and that sometimes analysts will have a good gauge on, for instance, you know, loan-to-value ratios, changing. And maybe committees will say, well, this pool of RMBS, the loan to value ratios were more, so we're gonna change, you know, we're gonna add or we're gonna subtract based on that. And it'll be common for that to happen because there hasn't been a change to the model yet, but the marketplace has changed. And that's not necessarily taking place in the public model, but it's taking place in the committee.
Well, I have to tell you, sir, that I never participated in a rating committee during all my time, and so I'm sure that the information that you are receiving from Mr. Siegel is better information than you would receive from myself.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Rutherford, there's been some suggestions in the various reform debates and commentaries that have been published over the last few years about the concept of having a chief rating officer or a chief quantitative officer at rating agencies, so that the actual persons involved in the rating process would report up through this person who would not be part of the business line, versus reporting up through a managing director and team MD who ultimately may be involved in the business aspects as opposed to just purely the rating process. Is the concept of a chief rating officer or a chief quantitative rating officer, is that something, a concept that you considered during your tenure as CEO? And what are your thoughts on having such a structure?
I did not consider it, nor do I think any of the senior managers considered it at Moody's when I was there. It's certainly possible. I don't know that it would be particularly desirable.
Why not?
You know, the objective is to provide good ratings, and you know that isn't necessarily something to be relegated to an ivory tower of an abstract chief rating officer.
And could you elaborate on that? I'm not sure I follow.
Well, the assumption behind that has to be that somehow that person will be better informed, smarter, something more positive than the existing process. And I don't know why there is a basis for reaching that conclusion.
In other words, you don't see a need to have a chief rating officer separate from a business line.
Well, there is always a need for somebody to monitor forecasting accuracy. And, you know, my recollection is that, or my understanding is that Moody's has made many changes after my tenure to strengthen the analytical quality of its ratings, and to provide increased resources and authority to the area of you know, the chief credit officer, Richard Cantor, but I don't hear those changes as being the same as the position that you're talking about and you're asking me questions about.
I see. Let's maybe move on to a few different topics. We had mentioned Brian Clarkson. What kind of manager was Brian Clarkson, in your view?
I very much like Brian. I think he was a strong business manager. He expected and demanded both for himself and for all the people who worked for him excellence in every aspect of the business. I thought he was an excellent manager.
And you said he was a strong business manager. What were some of his achievements that you recall that stand out in your mind?
I believe that he did improve customer service in the structured finance area. He greatly improved a number of the models that the company used to rate structured finance securities. He replaced weak managers with stronger managers.
Who were some of the managers he replaced?
The only one I can recall is Mr. Adelson.
But were there others? You used the term managers, plural. Were there others that you just can't recall their names?
Well, I can only recall one additional name, and it turns out it's not in the structured finance area. When I was at Moody's, Brian was also responsible for the public finance area. And he replaced Dennis Farrell as a manager.
And do you recall the reason why?
He didn't believe he was a strong manager.
Can you elaborate on what he may have said?
I can't recall.
Raymond McDaniel, what was your view, or what is your view of Mr. McDaniel as an executive at Moody's?
I recommended to the board that he be my successor, and I did that because I thought he had a very complete knowledge of the business. In all aspects, and what would be necessary for the business to be successful in the future.
And what were those characteristics? Did he have some particular characteristics that stood out in your mind as making him well suited?
Well, he had lengthy experience with the company. He had experience on both the structured finance side and the international side of the business. And we had talked about those being two of the important growth drivers for the business. Mm-hmm. He was, he's an excellent communicator. You know, people, he speaks very clearly and people understand what he is saying. He's a very hard worker. He's completely honest, and he's a very nice individual.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rutherford, I'd like to ask you about one of your major shareholders, and that's Warren Buffett. Mr. Buffett, I understand, invested in 1999 in Dun & Bradstreet, and then again in February of 2000 in Dun & Bradstreet. And he remained throughout your tenure one of the largest, if not the largest, shareholder. What was your interaction with Mr. Buffett, either before his purchases in Dun & Bradstreet or after he became a shareholder in Dun & Bradstreet and then ultimately Moody's?
I had no personal contact with Mr. Buffett, you know, before Moody's became a public company. After Moody's became a public company, I believe that I visited Mr. Buffett three or four times. Would go out there and have a meeting with Mr. Buffett and have lunch and then leave. Generally, from my perspective, the purpose of the conversation was to see whether Mr. Buffett had any suggestions for the business or suggestions specifically for the financial policy of the business.
And during the course of your visits with Mr. Buffett, did he ever express any recommendations to you?
Well, I think in terms of financial policy, Mr. Buffett agreed with what we were doing. And that was, we were specifically discussing dividend policy and share repurchase.
Did you ever discuss any compensation structures or any compensation issues at all with Mr. Buffett?
I do not recall discussing any compensation issues at all with Mr. Buffett.
Okay. Outside of talking about dividends, what other topics did you talk about with Mr. Buffett?
Well, we talked about share repurchase.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss whether or not Moody's was going to repurchase its shares?
Well, Moody's did have a share repurchase program at that time, and the program was, I'm going to call this, of the Buffett style, as opposed to what I'm going to call the Wall Street style. And what I mean with this, by this, was that Mr. Buffett had made comments publicly that companies should repurchase their shares when they believed the shares were not too expensive, and they should not repurchase their shares when they believed that they were too expensive, extended to shares issued under stock options. And what I mean by the Wall Street style was that companies should repurchase shares for the purpose of increasing their earnings per share.
I see. So you had discussions with Mr. Buffett about the share purchasing policies at Moody's?
Yes, sir.
Did you have any discussions with him at all about any strategic decisions with respect to the business?
The only one I can remember was, you know, Mr. Buffett was very interested in integrity, and as we agreed, certainly a failure of integrity would be a major negative for the company and for its shareholders. And so we I'm sure, discussed matters such as we have discussed today about how to manage conflicts of interest and the code of conduct for the company and for its employees.
Do you recall discussing those topics? I want to make sure you said, I'm sure we would talk about those comments, those topics. Do you have a recollection of talking about those topics with Mr. Buffett?
I have a recollection that Mr. Buffett raised the issue of integrity, and we told Mr. Buffett, I told Mr. Buffett what we were doing to so that the company would maintain its integrity.
And when was this? When do you recall having the conversation with Mr. Buffett about integrity?
I would guess it would have been 2002 or 2003.
And what prompted this conversation? Was there any event that prompted it, like Enron?
I don't recall. Okay. I think Mr. Buffett just felt that, you know, it was the number one thing that a rating agency ought to have.
And when you talk about integrity, are you speaking of integrity in the rating process?
I'm talking about integrity across the board. You know, integrity in the rating process, integrity in the financial reporting process, integrity in, you know, dealing and complying with the laws in all the company's jurisdictions.
And just to be clear, Mr. Rutherford, this was in the context of Mr. Buffett as a shareholder of Moody's, as opposed to being, and Mr. Buffett in the context of being the CEO of a company that Moody's rates. In other words, this conversation wasn't in the context of Mr. Buffett wearing the hat of CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, which is rated by Moody's, but rather in the context of Mr. Buffett being the CEO of a major shareholder of Moody's.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay. It was in the context of him being a shareholder, in other words.
It was in the context of Mr. Buffett being a shareholder of Moody's, and I think at that time the largest shareholder.
Mm-hmm. Did you provide any documents to Mr. Buffett in response to his question or questions concerning integrity?
No, sir, I don't believe we did. I did.
Who was present at that meeting?
The chief financial officer of Moody's, whose name at the time was Gene Deering. Mm-hmm.
Anyone else?
The issue may have come up in my last meeting with Mr. Buffett, which was attended by Ray McDaniel, because I was about to retire. But my recollection was that it came up in a previous meeting where the other person at the meeting would have been Gene Deering.
Mm-hmm. What about from Berkshire Hathaway? Was anyone else present?
No, sir.
Okay. And what I want to just make sure we're complete in terms of everything that was discussed at this meeting. Can you recall for me everything that you remember being discussed? Either anything that you said, anything that he said?
Well, Mr. Buffett's office contained a number of old Moody's manuals. And Mr. Buffett mentioned that, you know, he used the Moody's manuals in some of his earlier research for investment decisions which he had made. I remember that Mr. Buffett talked about baseball, but I frankly can't remember what he said. And I'm sorry that That's all I recall at this time. Mm-hmm.
And the Moody's manuals, can you forgive me, Mr. Rutherford? I'm not familiar with the Moody's manuals that you're referencing. What were those? Are those listing of ratings? What are those, the Moody manuals that Mr. Buffett had in his office?
Yes, sir. Moody's used to be in the publication business, so it would produce manuals on. It had an insurance manual where it would list insurance companies and provide some information about them, some history of the company, some financial information about the company. I'm sure that the company can provide you with copies of all Moody's manuals, or at least pictures of them.
And you had mentioned that he had relied on some of these manuals. You're not suggesting, though, that he was relying on the ratings in there, but rather the subjective publications, the descriptive publications that Moody's had put out?
I think he was just using them in his own investment process. He felt that they were useful to him in his investment process. Now, just to be clear, Moody's had a division which published those manuals. I believe that Moody's sold that division probably in 98 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I see. So what he had wasn't a list of the ratings, but rather the publications.
Right.
Got it.
I mean, the publication may have included the ratings, but I believe that what he was saying was that he found the publication useful in his early investment decision.
I see. Anything else from that conversation that you had with Mr. Buffett, the conversation where integrity came up?
No, sir. All I can say is Mr. Buffett did write me a nice letter about my first report to shareholders.
Well, do you still have that letter?
I don't. I think I was foolish enough not to keep it.
And was that meeting you've described in his office where you talked about integrity and talked about the manuals and talked about baseball, was that the most substantive meeting that you've had with him, or have you had other meetings of that nature?
I think I had three meetings, but they were all of that nature. And then afterwards, I think at the first one we went to the restaurant in his building. And then after the other meetings, we went to the outside restaurant that he usually takes people to. Mm-hmm. His name I can't remember, I'm sorry.
Okay, and the meeting you had with Mr. Buffett, where Mr. McDaniel was there, was that also in Omaha?
Yes, sir.
And what type of conversation, or what did you discuss during your conversation with Mr. Buffett while Mr. McDaniel was there?
The only thing I remember is that I introduced Mr. McDaniel to Mr. Buffett as my successor.
I see.
You know, and that's all I can remember.
How long was that meeting?
Oh, probably an hour and a half, and followed by lunch.
Okay. Do you ever remember Mr. Buffett opining either before a decision was made or after a decision was made with respect to a business decision, not with respect to a financial decision such as repurchasing shares or issuing dividends, but with respect to a business decision?
No, sir.
Okay. Did he, or do you just not recall?
I don't recall him providing any such opinion.
Okay. Some have described Mr. Buffett's role at Moody's as being a passive investor. Is that how you would classify it?
Yes. I mean, he didn't suggest he didn't suggest any business activity or management activity. We had requested of him whether he had any recommendations for the board. He made such a recommendation, but the individual wasn't available.
You mean he recommended a person to be on the board?
Yes, sir.
Who did he recommend?
I can describe him generically, but I don't remember his name. I believe there was a British person who he installed as head of Salomon Brothers, and who at the time was working for Citicorp, and Citicorp did not wish him to be an outside director.
What year would that have been?
2000.
Okay. Did you discuss prior to the spinoff the fact that there would be a spinoff with Mr. Buffett? Do you recall? That would have been while you were president but not CEO, I believe, if my notes are correct here.
No. Okay. I had no discussions with Mr. Buffett before the spinoff and before I was CEO.
Understood. Did Mr. Buffett, aside from the director from Salomon and formerly of Salomon and who was then at Citigroup that you've generically described, were there any other directors that Mr. Buffett either actively endorsed or recommended to you or recommended to anyone that you know of?
Is it fair that your question is, did Mr. Buffett recommend anybody else as a board member?
It was, but a little bit more broader. Let's first take the more narrow question of, did Mr. Buffett recommend anyone else as a board member?
I'm not sure that I would use the word to be as strong as recommended, but he certainly... And I apologize, this isn't a joke. I think he mentioned Melinda Gates.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
Probably 2002 or 2003.
Anyone else that he suggested as a director?
Not that I can recall.
Did you explore the option of Melinda Gates as a director?
No, sir.
Why not?
It just didn't seem reasonable that she would be interested.
And did Mr. Buffett support the election of any director or directors aside from his votes themselves? Did he ever speak out and say, I'm supporting this person as director? Were there any such communications?
No, sir, there were not any such communications.
Was there any director during your tenure as CEO that you would have deemed to be the Buffett director or someone who was there because of Mr. Buffett?
No, there was nobody there because of Mr. Buffett.
Okay. Did you ever go through and do any explanation of how the rating process worked to Mr. Buffett? in the context of him being a shareholder as opposed to being CEO of a rated company?
No, I can't recall any such discussion with Mr. Buffett.
Okay. Did you provide any information ever to Mr. Buffett aside from the information that would go to other shareholders? I mean, did you ever send him any specific information, either sua sponte or at his request?
No, we did not. I mean, you know, we the discussion of share repurchase and his philosophy, was done verbally. We didn't send him any materials about that, and we didn't send him any materials other than normal shareholder communications.
Mm-hmm. You didn't send anything about the rating process, the integrity of the process, or anything like that?
No.
Okay. Do you have an opinion about whether Moody's made any mistakes leading up to or during the financial crisis with its ratings of structured finance products?
When I was there, I do not believe that we were making mistakes about the structured finance products. Mm-hmm.
And you have a view as to after you left whether or not, in light of the number of downgrades and the timing of those downgrades, whether Moody's made any mistakes in its rating of structured finance products?
Well, all I can say was that, you know, the I think it is clear that the ratings did not perform. The ratings of certain structured finance products didn't perform in the way that they should have performed. The word mistake that you use is very concrete. And I'm not sure that there were any mistakes as such. I'm not really sure.
What about just simply errors?
There were assumptions that didn't prove to be correct. Just because they didn't prove to be correct doesn't mean that they were wrong or that there were errors. I believe that the assumptions were at the time honestly made.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rutherford, the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations held a hearing recently on the credit rating agencies. It was on April 23rd of this year, 2010. Did you have occasion to watch that hearing or read anything about that hearing?
I did have the occasion to watch some of it.
Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I thought that Mr. McDaniel was a good witness. I thought he did a good job in communicating his points of view.
The Permanent Subcommittee released a series of findings as well concerning the credit rating agencies, both Moody's and Standard & Poor's, regarding several different items. Did you happen to read those findings at all?
No, sir. I did not read the findings.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Wait a moment. Are those or those, was that before the doc? They released some documents. Were the findings that they released before the documents?
Yes, sir. That's them.
I may have read them.
Okay.
I think I probably read some of them or read it quickly.
What was there? Was there anything that caught your attention? Was there anything that stood out at you in those findings? Surprised you, or were you taken aback by any of the findings that you read?
I certainly don't recall now that any of the findings took me back or surprised me.
It was suggested at the hearing and in the findings that competitive pressures, including the drive for market share and the need to accommodate investment bankers bringing in business, affected the credit ratings issued by Moody's. Do you have a view of whether that is a correct or fair finding?
We always try to maintain our standards, and people were always lobbying us one way or another, but I believe that at least when I was there, I think we were able to maintain our standards.
There were emails that were released as well. It sounds like you may have seen some of those emails. Is that correct? Documents, emails?
I read through the things very quickly, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And did anything stand out at you as those emails as unusual? Something that was an outlier from your time at Moody's?
I don't recall any Moody's emails that struck me.
Okay. As we started at the outset, Mr. Cunicelli mentioned, my colleague here, Mr. Cunicelli mentioned that we are investigating the causes of the financial crisis. In your opinion, do you think that credit ratings and their apparent failure to predict accurately the credit quality of structured finance products such as residential mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations caused or contributed to the financial crisis?
I believe that there were some large institutions that inappropriately did not include certain instruments in their risk management and risk control practices because they were rated AAA, and some of the losses of those institutions had to be socialized.
What institutions do you have in mind?
UBS, possibly Merrill, Bayer. Well, Bayer is a little different.
Why was Bayer different? Because they were buying the equity that was unrated, or what?
I'm not sure that the losses of Bayer became socialized.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that's I misunderstood you. I thought you were, but yes, that's fair. Please continue. Sorry.
In other words, I think that, I don't know whether I'm allowed to just make an opinion, but I think that your committee should focus on processes that require losses to be socialized.
In other words, the too big to fail issue and the government intervention part, is that what you're recommending?
Right, that governments had to put in taxpayer money to bail out certain financial institutions.
Mm-hmm. Sir, the rating agencies downgraded securities en masse in July and October of 2007. Some have pointed to these sudden downgrades of securities in July and October of 2007 as being a catalyst for the financial crisis, or a contributing factor to the crisis, these sudden and massive downgrades that I've described in July and October. Is that a view that you subscribe to? And if so, what is why do you subscribe to that? And if not, why do you disagree with that?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I think that's an empirical question. And I understand why you would want to find that out, but I'm not sure that you can find it out for me. I mean, my recommendations are that ratings were put too much into regulation. And, you know, ratings are supposed to be a forecast of likelihood to make promised payments. And, you know, by putting them into regulation, people can say they're more than just a forecast or more than just an opinion. And I don't think you want institutional investors to do that. You want them to do their own due diligence and make their own decisions.
What sort of reform efforts in the area of credit rating agencies do you see as necessary?
Well, the first is removing them from regulation, from regulations. The rating agencies, it is appropriate to regulate rating agencies, but rating agency ratings shouldn't be the basis of you know, what mutual funds can buy or the capital that banks or other financial institutions should hold. And, you know, the other thing is you need more disclosure to structured finance investors.
Mm-hmm. And given the lack of disclosure to structured finance investors, do you believe that the investors of structured finance products rely on the ratings issued by the rating agencies such as Moody's?
Well, they shouldn't. Rating agents, investors need to do their own due diligence. They need to form their own credit opinions. They can use ratings as a tool, but they should not rely on ratings. And bank risk management processes should certainly not fail to include securities in those processes just because they have ratings.
Do you think the institutions that relied upon these ratings then, and I'll withdraw that because you've spoken of the institutions, the investment banks, but do you think that investors also, though, relied upon those ratings for structured finance vehicles, such as CDOs, and relied to their detriment?
I'm not aware of you know, individual, either any individual or collective investors who made that reliance. What I'm saying that I'm just commenting on some statements by bank senior managers that they did their risk management processes did not include certain securities because they were highly rated.
Mm-hmm. With respect to reform efforts, you've mentioned removing the references to ratings and regulations. Would you support any other efforts, like imposing legal liability on credit rating agencies or their ratings, increased competition efforts, or any sort of regulation or approval process by any agencies of the methodologies or the models? Or some have suggested the allocation of the rating work by a federal agency. Do you have any opinions on any of those type of reforms? Would you support any of those?
I'm sorry. You mentioned a number of areas in a list.
Yes, sir.
And if you could ask them to me individually, I'll try to respond to you, sir.
That's a fair point, sir. And if this were some sort of deposition, which it's not, your very skilled counsel next to you would have objected to that question. But I was merely trying to expedite the process to get you out of there. I know we've spent a lot of time, and I appreciate your time. Let's take these one by one, though. Legal liability on credit rating agencies. Is that something that you've thought about? Would you support that?
Well, I mean, ratings are a forecast. And I believe that ratings need to be fairly made, without corruption, that there is legal liability if ratings are made through a corrupt process. But to the extent that there is a forecast, I don't think that you can decide that the weatherman was wrong if he forecast that there's going to be a thunderstorm and there isn't, or that he forecasts that there isn't going to be a thunderstorm and there is. And that's the way I feel about liability for a single individual rating. I don't believe you can tell from a single rating whether the rating was right or wrong.
Another area that has been discussed has been the lack of competition. Some have described the ratings business in structured finance as being a duopoly. Others have said it's an oligopoly. Point being, there are few participants on the ratings side with respect to structured finance products. There have been reform efforts described to increase competition in those areas. Is that something that you think is a wise reform, given your experience?
Well, to be honest with you, I think the objective of efforts should be to increase quality, and that increased competition doesn't necessarily mean increased quality. And you have some examples of industry structure with only two major participants where there's a tremendous amount of competition. And I would point to the Boeing and Airbus as an example of that. So, my view is the objective shouldn't be to increase competition for competition's sake, but to think about what could be done, if anything, to increase quality.
And what would you recommend as far as any efforts to increase quality on the rating side? Anything that could be done there?
My favorite recommendation is that rating agencies should be required to publish cardinal estimates of default probabilities as well as their current ratings.
And what do you mean by that, sir?
Current rating systems of S&P and Moody's and I believe Fitch are all ordinal. That is, they have to do with ordinally which securities are more creditworthy and which securities are less creditworthy. The idea of a cardinal system is to ask rating agencies to produce estimates of default or loss for various time periods. And I don't think rating agencies will be particularly good at that at the beginning, but I think they will greatly improve if they are asked to do that.
Mr. Rutherford, was there a time previously that Moody's used to publish ratings even if they were not selected or paid for a rating?
My understanding of your question is, was there a time when Moody's had a subscriber pay business model? Is that correct?
Not really. It's a bit different. I think that Moody's at one time had a policy where, irrespective of whether they were being paid by the issuer, they would publish a rating.
In other words, Mr. Rutherford, the unsolicited rating process, that eventually stopped with respect to structured finance products specifically and elsewhere as well. Do you think that the unsolicited rating process, that's something that might be a necessary improvement improvement to the quality of ratings? Is that something that you would support?
I would, yes. And I've already commented on improving disclosure in structured finance. The reason why rating agencies didn't issue unsolicited ratings on structured finance products was that they were unable to obtain the information necessary to do those ratings. My belief is that all investors should be given the necessary information to make their own informed credit judgments on structured finance securities, and that might enable rating agencies who wish to do so to do unsolicited ratings of structured products. I'm not sure. Was that responsive?
It was very responsive, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. You had given us some further thought, and I to areas that we should look into. We ask all of our witnesses with whom we speak if there is anything additional they would like to add, or any thoughts or opinions, any areas that we didn't talk about today that you think we should talk about, or any other parting words of wisdom for us. Do you have any additional thoughts, words of wisdom for us?
Well, I think we've covered the topics that I expected. I can't think of anything else, but I will certainly tell Ms. Nellis if I do think of anything. Otherwise, I should say that I've done my best to recall today, but I may have made some incorrect recollections. And I would refer you with respect to some questions about models to the two individuals that you mentioned in the model area. I think it was Jay Siegel and Roger Stein. And I think probably you should talk to Mr. Clarkson about Mr. Farrow and Mr. Adelson. And both to Brian and Ray about the company's efforts to ensure rating quality. I've done my best, but frankly, some of this is quite a long time ago.
Great. Well, we appreciate that, sir, and certainly we appreciate that caveat. And your efforts to recall matters. Our process, as we mentioned at the outset, unless and until this interview is released publicly, it remains confidential. And so we ask that, just to preserve the integrity of our process, you don't discuss anything we talked about today with anyone outside of your counsel, Ms. Nellis.
I understand that and will comply.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much. And if there's any thoughts or ideas that you do have now, between now and December 15th of this year, when our report is due to the president, we certainly would welcome and appreciate any of your thoughts and your reflections and experience about rating agencies or about any topic. So consider that, sir, an open invitation if you ever have any thoughts to share those through Ms. Nellis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bonney and Mr. Cunicelli. I appreciated talking, the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate your time. We're going off record, and it's 3:30.